thank you so much that we have a universe that we can look into, that we can explore, because it can bolster our faith. Thank you so much for this class, for this beautiful day. We ask your blessing on Dr. Ross as he teaches this morning. In Jesus' name, amen. Dr. Hugh Ross.
Okay, again, come to the microphone if you've got questions you want to ask. And by the way, there's no one behind you. You can ask as many questions as you like. But for my benefit, one question, let me answer it. Make a second question, I'll answer that. I don't want to have to remember six questions all at once. Just to get things started, you've probably heard that today is the 70th birthday of Stephen Hawking. And for his 70th birthday, he was asked what was the most challenging problem facing him in cosmology. And he said, trying to unravel the mystery of women. So it is interesting, though, that even Stephen Hawking is perplexed by the mystery of women. But something else he said today when he was interviewed, he's actually too ill to attend his party. And by the way, when physicists get together to have a party, when they want to celebrate, they do this, by the way, routinely for any well-known physicist or astronomer who has a 60th birthday. But for Stephen Hawking, they decided to do it again on his 70th birthday. You know what they do? They have a paper fest. So all of the friends of the physicist or astronomer get together in a large auditorium and present a dozen or so scientific papers in honor of the person whose birthday is being celebrated. As far as I know, Hawking, the only physicist of this century, has actually had two such birthday celebrations. So a birthday fest is going on right now in Cambridge, United Kingdom. Paper after paper is being delivered by a number of well-known physicists and astronomers. But because he was too ill to attend his own party, he was interviewed this morning about what he considered to be the biggest problems facing physicists and humanity in general. And his comment is, we're ruining our planet, and we got to leave our planet within 100 years. So he was saying astronomers really need to start finding a planet that's going to be a suitable habitat because of the way we're messing up our planet. And he's famous. In his recent book published September before last, titled, again, trying to think of it, The Grand Design, where he basically said, we know there is no God necessary to explain the universe because we're finding hundreds of these planets outside of our solar system, and all these planets are proving there's nothing special about our solar system planets, and there's nothing special about our solar system planets. Therefore, there's nothing special about the universe. Well, he is a theoretical physicist, a theoretical astrophysicist. Based on those comments, I don't think he really paid much attention to what observers are producing. And by the way, you don't have to be a theoretical astrophysicist. All you've got to do is put into your computer search engine, Exoplanet Encyclopedia, and up will pop up all the characteristics of every planet discovered outside of our solar system. As of this morning, 716 planets have not only been discovered, but measured in terms of their various characteristics. And if you look at that list, what you'll find is that none of them come anywhere close to having the characteristics of any of the planets in our solar system. It's the exact opposite of what Stephen Hawking claims. None of the planets we have found are anything like the planets we've discovered in our solar system. Moreover, none of the stars that we've been able to measure in our galaxy, and we've now measured millions of them with sufficient precision, are proving to be an adequate twin to the Sun. What I mean by that is characteristics sufficiently like the Sun that it would be possible that a planet could orbit it that could support advanced life. Now, people I went to graduate school with are now heading up the search for extraterrestrial intelligent life. And this is something else that Hawking commented on this morning. He said, you know, we do get signals from these intelligent beings elsewhere, but we would be best advised not to respond. And people asked him why. He said, well, look what happened to the Indians here in North America. When the Europeans came, it wasn't exactly good news for them. So he says, given that they would be superior to us and probably have personalities similar to us, they'd want to take us over and suppress us or kill us off. So it'd be best just to keep quiet. But I can tell you this, every star that my friends are searching for extraterrestrial intelligent signals, we already know is a non-candidate for intelligent life. We already know that the star has characteristics that rule out the possibility that intelligent life could possibly be existing on a planet orbiting that system. Moreover, every system where we found planets has characteristics that rule out the possibility of advanced life existing there. And in summary, what we discovered through looking at all these extrasolar planets is that every planet in our solar system, now that we've demoted Pluto to an asteroid status, every planet plays a critical role in making life possible here on planet Earth. In fact, the amazing thing they've been discovering by looking at all these extrasolar planets is how many, like Neptune and Uranus, are orbiting closer to the star than our Earth orbits our Sun. And that would mean that, you know, those planets can only form far out, and it means that as they drift in close, they would be guaranteed to disturb the orbit of any planet with a capacity for supporting advanced life. And that's been the amazing thing. Half the planets we're discovering by the transit method, which is a relatively complete method for detecting planets where they are detectable, half of them are coming in as Neptunes and super-Earths. Super-Earth is a planet 100 to 1,000% bigger than our Earth, and then the Neptunes are 10 to 30 times bigger than our Earth. So literally half the planets are coming in at that size. And those kinds of planets orbiting close to their star systems sort of rule out the possibility for advanced life. I don't see anybody coming behind the microphone yet, so what I'm going to talk about is something on a completely different discipline of science. And by the way, I've got, 50 papers here we could talk about, recent discoveries. I mean, literally, every day, there are about 10 scientific papers published that give us more evidence for the existence of God and the Christian faith. But one that we did a podcast on just this past Friday was on beavers. A paper got published on beavers. And I grew up in Canada, and so, you know, beavers are the national animal for Canada. For very good reasons, it was beavers that founded the launch of Canada as a country. In fact, for 200 years, beavers were virtually the sole support of the Canadian economy. But what they've been able to discover through space satellites doing deep radar imaging, which means that they're able to actually image stuff underground, they found out that in Canada and the United States, beavers that existed before the Europeans came here were responsible for producing 30 to 50% of the post-glacial sediments. And the process they discovered those sediments played a key role and maximizing the biomass of North America, and now they're playing a bigger role in benefiting human beings in the sense that the dams that beavers build up sediment behind the dams, and those sediments allow a much bigger biomass to be supported, fish, birds, mammals, even reptiles, amphibians, plants that flourish because of the wetlands and wet meadows that have been developed by beavers. Matter of fact, I've got a slide here I'm going to show you. Here we go. Let's bring this one up. This is a photograph of a beaver hut that I took in Canada this past summer. And there's a dam behind that hut. And what that beaver dam has done is produce more than 100 acres of wet meadow and wetlands habitat. And therefore, it's able to support fish and birds and a lot of grazing large mammals. Now, the other thing you notice is that that little beaver hut there is a little bit deceptive. That thing is about 10 feet high. So it's a big hut. But what happens in the wintertime is snow falls on that and produces an igloo, which keeps the beavers warm even when the temperature drops down to 40 or 50 below zero, and also provides habitat space for other animals that are not able to handle the extreme cold. But the production of these dams and the sediment that builds up behind it removes both carbon and nitrogen from the water. The removal of nitrogen is critical because the nitrogen, if left there, will eutrophy the water. What do I mean by that? It produces these toxic algae blooms, which basically remove oxygen from the water and kill off all the fish and kill off all the animals that depend on those fish. And by removing the carbon, this eliminates the possibility that the chlorine we dump into all these waters, that's a problem with 300 million people now living in Canada and the United States. They're dumping huge quantities of chlorine into all these waterways. But because of beaver dams, the chlorine normally would bond to the carbon and produce carcinogens, which would mean that people living further downstream are going to get cancer. And for that reason, you're a little bit better off living in Colorado than you are living here in California, because the farther downstream you are, the more carcinogens are in the water. But if you've got enough beavers building dams, that will remove the carcinogens from the water. And this is something I've written about in my book that you'll see over there, Hidden Treasures in the Book of Job, how God gave us the rodents, the short-legged land mammals that it describes in Genesis 1:24, as a clothing source. The wonderful thing about rodents, and beavers rank as the second largest rodent on the planet, the wonderful thing about rodents, they're warm-blooded, they live in cold climates, and they have a high body temperature. And therefore, to survive, they have to grow very thick, luxuriant fur, which we humans exploit for clothing purposes, at least until PETA came along and artificial materials. And I remember growing up in Canada, a friend of mine actually had one of these beaver coats, and because there was a raging blizzard outside, I had to go outside and do some chores, he let me borrow his beaver coat, and it kept me nice and warm. So that's how beavers served in the launch of human civilization. The first humans needed clothing. As I describe in the book, the wonderful thing about the human body, it's best designed large-bodied mammal for being able to survive in a hot climate. We human beings are better adapted for a hot climate than any other large-bodied mammal. Why? Because we're bipedal, we're tall, we're slim, which means not much sunlight falls on our body. We don't have a lot of fur on our bodies, and therefore we can dissipate heat efficiently, and we have this wonderful hydration system. We humans can literally sweat. In fact, I saw this once. I was working at a time when it was 138 degrees outside, and I had to do some repairs on radio telescopes, and I was actually sweating a liter of water every 20 minutes. That's so efficient the human body is able to produce sweat. But we're very poorly adapted for warm climates. Wonderfully adapted for warm climates, very poorly adapted for cold climates. Because we dissipate heat so efficiently, we will literally shiver to death unless we got warm clothing that was provided for us by the rodents. Hey, we actually got people in front of the microphone now.
Yeah.
I'm going to keep quiet, and if things produce a lull, well, I've got a few more discoveries we can talk about. But hey, if you want to hear more about the beavers, go to reasons.org. Look up Science Newsflash, and you can listen to a podcast there, and you can actually listen to it through your smartphone now. You don't need a computer. Go ahead.
Yes, I wonder how you explain phenomena like holy people levitating, or you know, the thousands of bodies that are incorrupt for holy people. How do you explain that?
Okay. I didn't catch the last part of your question. Thousands of people who...
Their bodies remain incorrupt after hundreds, thousands of years.
Remain...
incorrupt. hearing intact. You know, pardon me?
Are you talking about mummified?
Oh, not at all. These are Christians in the Catholic Church. There are books, they're incorruptibles. I mean, they have. A friend of mine went to Europe, and she was bothered by how many there were in the churches in Europe. These bodies that remain.
First part of your question again?
Well, just how do you explain these phenomenon, like, you know, saints levitating or these bodies not corrupting after hundreds or thousands of years, remaining in perfect condition. I mean, they open up their eyes and they're a little blue or in there.
Okay. Well, I do know of documented accounts of people dying and being dead for a period of time and then coming back to life. I don't know of any documented accounts of levitated bodies. I've heard claims, but nothing that can be proven. So the idea, and by the way, it's not just Roman Catholics that make these claims. Hindus and Buddhists will also claim. You know, Hare Krishna, for example, and Maharishi Mahesh Yogi claim that his followers could levitate their bodies off the ground. And they had photos, but the photos were clearly fake. So there's no evidence, no believable evidence that any human being is able to levitate their body above the ground. And likewise, there's no evidence that dead people's bodies do not decay.
But there are thousands of them. I mean, you can
look at it online.
I mean,
documented evidence.
That their bodies are there.
Well, I'll give you a biblical context.
Okay.
Seven places in the Bible, it tells us that the laws of physics don't change. Jeremiah 33:25, for example, says that the laws that govern the heavens and the earth are fixed. And when you go to Romans 8:18-23, it speaks about this pervasive law of decay, what we physicists would call the second law of thermodynamics, or the law of entropy, how everything in the universe is subject to decay. The entire realm, the entire universe, is subject to this law of decay. So it means that anything left to itself will decay. That includes your closet, that includes your garage, your bedroom, it includes your physical body, which means that if a body dies, it will decay. The only exception to that was the tree of life that was in the Garden of Eden. And Adam and Eve, I believe, were also subject to the law of decay, but they had the option of going to the tree of life, partaking of the fruit of the tree of life, and reversing the effects of that decay. But without access to the tree of life, you will decay. In fact, all of us are evidence that the law of decay is pervasive, right? Don't you see more decay in your body than you saw 10 years ago? I certainly do. And I even see it in my children. I mean, you know, you can look at a 10-year-old, and you will see little tiny liver spots on the skin of that 10-year-old. So even children are in the process of decaying. Everything is subject to the decay. And by the way, there's a very good reason why there's this pervasive law of decay. It's one of the tools God uses to tackle the problem of sin and evil and suffering. I won't time to go into that physics in detail, but there's a book over there called Why the Universe is the Way It Is, which explains why, as long as there's sin and evil around, there must be this pervasive law of decay that applies literally to everything. Now, I'm aware of the claims. My response back to you is there is no credible evidence for any of those claims. So,
But how would you explain that they are? I mean, I could go touch them. How do you explain that they are there? Their body is physically there and not decayed.
Okay, keep in mind that there are atheist organizations that are going after believers who make these claims. And say, give us some evidence. And they've never been able to produce any evidence. Nothing that could be persuasive to a scientist. So, I mean, bring the individual here. We'll see. So, okay. Go ahead.
Thank you. Good morning. The thing that blocks me from having faith is the presence of evil in the world, of which there is a lot of. But just to bring it, you know, on a smaller scale, when I watch the evening news, say, And I hear about children being kidnapped and murdered and hurt and worse. I say to myself, where's God? How could something like this happen? And I try and explain it in my own mind. I say, well, it's for some greater good, or the child was a sinner somehow and deserved it, or I just cannot come up with any plausible explanation that feels satisfying to me when these kind of things happen in our cities. So well, that's my skepticism.
Yes. Well, you're hardly alone. That is the number one reason produced by atheists for their atheism. They say if there's an all-powerful God out there who's all-loving towards the human species, why would such an all-powerful, all-loving God tolerate his creatures experiencing evil and suffering? Incidentally, that's the only positive evidence for an atheistic worldview. Most of the arguments I hear from atheists are what I would call negative. The fact that we Christians have such poor arguments for our faith. But that's really an attack against us. It's not an attack against God. The one piece of positive evidence they have is the argument you just presented, the argument from the existence of evil. Now, what you see in the Christian faith that's distinct from all the other religions of the world is a two-creation model. And this is something I noticed when I was 17 and 18, checking out the different religions of the world, that every religion outside of Christianity presented a one-creation model, where God creates the universe. He puts humanity in paradise. In fact, it was interesting. Every religion I studied had the same story for the origin of humanity, that we all began in some kind of paradisical condition, the Garden of Eden, as the Bible talks about it. They also all agree in saying that we lost access to the paradise by some means or form. But their message is that God is in the business of restoring us to paradise. Now, when I picked up the Bible, I saw the same story. Adam and Eve in paradise, Adam and Eve being kicked out of paradise. But what I saw that was very different is that God is not on a mission to restore us to paradise. He's on a mission to deliver us from paradise to something that's far better than paradise. And keep in mind, God had the option of keeping Adam and Eve and their human progeny in paradise for the rest of eternity. So we literally could have existed for all of eternity without any exposure to evil or suffering. But God chose to allow evil to come in. Satan could not have gotten into the garden unless God allowed him. God opened the gate for the Garden of Eden, had Satan come in knowing exactly what was going to happen when he put Adam and Eve to the test. Adam and Eve were no match for the most powerful, most intelligent creature that God ever created. But that set in motion a plan on the part of our Creator to take humanity from paradise to something far better. And the point here is, you can't get to the new creation without first being trained by exposure to evil and suffering. So the evil and suffering really are serving a higher good. But if there is no new creation, like you see in Hinduism or Buddhism, then evil and suffering is gratuitous. It is pointless. It is completely inconsistent with an all-powerful, all-loving God. But given that we have this new creation to look forward to, which is so much better than paradise, then we can see why it would be necessary for us to be exposed temporarily to evil and suffering in order that we can be prepared and trained to receive something far better. So the one thing Adam and Eve lacked that people here in the audience possess, they lacked eternal security. They lacked the knowledge that they would be secure in their loving relationship with their Creator for the rest of eternity. Why? Because God created them as free will beings. There was always the risk that they would do the same thing that Satan and the fallen angels did. And if it was done in the same context as the fallen angels, they would have been permanently removed from a relationship with the Creator. because of our exposure to evil and suffering, a pathway was made whereby we could be delivered from our fallen state and receive new life in Jesus Christ and an eternally secure relationship. And it's a little bit like the marriage relationship. You know, I've been involved in marrying a few couples, and in the premarital counseling session, I want to make sure their relationship has been tested. Because if it hasn't been tested, then probably the marriage is going to fall apart. And my goal as a pastor is that they would have a lifelong relationship that would get better and better as every year goes by. But that won't happen unless their relationship is put to the test. In the same way, God is putting it to the test. Or another analogy I could give you is, you know, I'm both a student and a professor. I take classes, but sometimes I teach classes. And the thing I've noticed as a professor is how willing my students are to pay my sponsoring institution considerable sums of money to suffer at my hands. Now, the reason why they're willing to suffer at my hand and actually pay money to suffer at my hand, they recognize, number one, the suffering is brief. And number two, it will give them access to a rewarding career that could last 40 or 50 years. And they also recognize, unless they suffer under my hand, they'll never get that goal. Well, likewise, God exposes us to a very brief period of suffering. It only lasts 80 or 90 years. And when those 80 or 90 years are done, your suffering is done, and it gives you access to a reward that lasts for the rest of eternity. Now, you can check out our book over there, Why the Universe is the Way It Is. I think the most helpful part of that book is giving people a vision for how great and majestic the rewards for the new creation will be. And I think one reason why people struggle with this problem of evil and suffering, they don't recognize where we've been, namely paradise, and where God wants to take us, and how big a difference there is between paradise and new creation. If we saw how enormous the difference is, I think we'd appreciate why it's necessary we go through this period of training. That also explains why God will not interrupt the second law of thermodynamics, except on exceptionally rare occasions. The second law, as you will find out if you look at the book, is critical for training and preparing us to enter the new creation. By the way, it's also true of the law of gravity, electromagnetism, and the rest of the laws of physics. And the moment that God conquers and removes evil once and for all, that will be the end of cosmic physics. I mean, I'm kind of amused reading what Stephen Hawking is saying, just how much he's dedicated his life to understanding something that from a physical perspective is temporal. There will come a time when the physics of this universe will be completely irrelevant. So I want to make sure I'm dedicating my life to more than just studying the physics of the universe. Anyway, thank you for the question. Very good question. Next person.
Hi. I have a question. I think you wrote somewhere, I don't remember where I saw it, but that you disagreed with the Kalam cosmological argument.
I do not disagree with a Kalam cosmological argument. What I've written is that the Kalam cosmological argument is vulnerable. It's vulnerable to attack from atheistic scientists.
How so?
And how so? Well, a number of scientists just glibly discount. By the way, I probably should say what the Kalam cosmological argument is. That might be helpful. It's basically the cosmological argument that was first proposed by Augustine, and it was kind of elaborated on by Aquinas and then by Kalam. And the argument is that the universe has a beginning, and if there's a beginning, there's got to be a beginner. And people will say, well, who started the beginning? The argument is there can't be an infinite regress of beginnings. There's got to be an ultimate first causer, an uncaused cause to the universe to explain the mere existence of the universe. Therefore, God must exist. So that's kind of the argument in a nutshell. Now, a number of physicists in the last 20 years, and Hawking is one of them, in his book, A Brief History of Time, he just dismissed the cosmological argument by suggesting that the universe may have a second dimension of time attached to it. So the universe has two dimensions of time, or actually what he said in his book, real time plus imaginary time. But if you know anything about complex variables, invoking imaginary time is equivalent to adding a second dimension of time. And if time is two-dimensional, then he pointed out there's no need for the universe at the beginning, and therefore what need is there for God? And, you know, to kind of help you visualize his argument, let's presume that time is like this plane. And in a plane, you can have as many timelines as you want in as many directions as you please. And so what Hawking was saying is, you could have a timeline over here, and you could have a timeline over here. And this timeline never crosses or touches that timeline, then the being existing in that timeline would have no beginning in this particular timeline. And if that were true of the universe would have no need for a beginning. But what a lot of readers of this book overlook, you read a few pages further on, and Hawking concedes that, of course, the universe that we measure is indeed constrained by a single dimension of time that can't be stopped or reversed. And so what he was basically coming up with was a what-if argument. What if the universe had two time dimensions? Then we could escape the need for God. But the truth is, the universe really is constrained to one dimension of time. More than that, it's time that can't be stopped or reversed. And any entity that's constrained to a single dimension of time that can't be stopped or reversed must have an ultimate beginning and therefore a beginner. And so we make that point, the column cosmological argument stands. When I wrote that piece, it was making the point that we have to deal with this new challenge to the column cosmological argument. And there are eight different experiments in physics that prove that time can't be stopped or reversed, and that time indeed is linear. Now, that's not true of the Creator. In creating the universe, God created time. That was the great contribution of Stephen Hawking that he made in 1970, the first of the space-time theorems, which proved that the beginning of the universe is the beginning of time and space. And that means that there must be a causal agent beyond time that creates the universe. And that causal agent must have access to the equivalent of two dimensions of time at a minimum. Because time is that dimension or realm in which cause and effect phenomena take place, and here's this causal agent bringing into existence time. Therefore, that being must have access at a minimum to the equivalent of two time dimensions, and therefore that being has no need for a beginning or a cause, which is the first statement, or the third statement, of a column cosmological argument, that there must be this being who has no beginning and is not created. The space-time theorems that, ironically, were first proposed by Stephen Hawking actually prove that, and now prove it to about 15 places of destiny.
Thank you.
Morning, Dr. Ross.
Morning.
Getting back to the anthropic principle that you started out with, we have a picture of God at the controls, manipulating the right distance from the sun, and so that to ensure the survival of his intelligent, caring, loving creatures, us. However, you didn't mention that this will change, and everything is changing. The distance to the sun will change and will be burned, or the sun will expand and wipe out all life. And we are simply enjoying an interlude in which, in a much larger cosmic drama. So you can't leave that out. That's sure. Physics never change in this, but things change in the cosmos, and so you have to include that in your talk. Thank you.
Well, no, you're making a good point there. The laws of physics don't change. It doesn't mean that local conditions within the universe will change. And you're quite correct. The sun is getting brighter and brighter as every year goes by.
Not such that any of us are going to notice it from year to year. It's a very slow change. But, for example, the sun today is about 15% brighter than it was 3.5 billion years ago. And so there will be a time in the relatively near future, at least from an astronomer's perspective, when the sun will be too bright to support life here on planet Earth. And incidentally, the first to suffer from that consequence will be human beings, if we're still here. Roughly 10 million years from now, the sun will be too bright to support anything as advanced as human beings, and bacteria will disappear in about 30 million years. So, yeah, things are not going to be pleasant for that much longer. But, you know, as a Christian, that gives me some optimism, namely that God is going to bring us into the new creation in a lot less than 10 million years. In fact, what you'll see in our book, Why the Universe is the Way It Is, the window of time is probably much briefer than that, at least in terms of being able to sustain any kind of advanced civilization. Probably 1,000 years is the limit. You know, our planet is running out of resources, and the greater the technology level and the greater the wealth level of the human population, the more that plays towards the extinction of the human population, in the sense that wealth and technology work for a much lower birth rate, and already where you've got significant wealth and technology, the birth rate is considerably below the replacement rate. In fact, what they found in places like Hong Kong and Singapore is that it reaches a point where it catastrophically begins to drop towards zero. In Singapore, for example, they're doing everything they can financially to encourage women to have children, but it's not working. The birth rate right now is 0.55 children per woman. And it's dropping literally every year. Well, just a few years ago, it was 0.75. In just a few years, it dropped down to 0.55. And I've been to Hong Kong, and I can see what the point is. If you're living in an urbanized area with a lot of wealth and technology, and if you're a young woman, the last thing you want to do is get married, because your standard of living is going to catastrophically drop. And so they tend to put off marriage for quite a while, or don't get married at all. And incidentally, the other issue with technology is that it forces you to postpone getting married just to get your career established. And the longer you postpone having children, the more deleterious mutations you pass on to the next generation. And for that reason, people who are interested in the search for extraterrestrial intelligent life have estimated that the longest period of time that any intelligent species anywhere in the universe could sustain technology as advanced as ours is currently is about 1,000 years. Now, that doesn't mean that's the end of humanity. It just means it's the end of humanity with wealth and technology. If we're willing to go back to a Stone Age technology with only a few million of us running around the planet, we can survive quite a bit longer. How much longer? We could probably extend our existence another 20 to 30,000 years tops. There are other reasons why, even with a Stone Age technology, you can't last for more than a few tens of thousands of years. But as I read the Bible, God's going to conquer the problem of evil in much shorter time than that, in which case the universe will have fulfilled its purpose. And what you read in the Bible, the moment that God conquers and eliminates evil, the universe will have fulfilled its purpose. God no longer has a use for it. As he's spoken into existence, he'll speak it out of existence and replace it with his brand new realm, the new creation, where we will be able to exist for the rest of eternity. So yes, you're right, Al. This universe cannot support life for a long period of time. The maximum time window for bacterium is about 4 billion years. The maximum time for something as advanced as human beings with any kind of technology is less than 40,000 years. And you're talking technology as advanced as what we have right now, less than 1,000 years. So yeah, we don't have a lot of time, which means we should take seriously the training program that God is taking us through. That's kind of what I tell my students. You only got 3 hours to take this exam. Make the best use of your time. I'm not going to give you any extension. And I've learned the hard way that if you give students too much time, they don't do as well in performing on the examinations. They will underperform if you give them too little time. They also underperform if you give them too much time. If you don't believe me, I'll just teach a class where you tell the students, you can take as long as you like to take this test. I can tell you, the more time you give them, the more poorly they will do, beyond a certain point. And God understands that as well. Go ahead.
Good morning. I was wondering, I know there are lots of different Christian points of view about the age of the earth.
Right.
And I wondered, how old do you believe the earth is and how you know?
How old do I think the earth is?
Yes, and how do you know?
Okay. Well, you can read an article that's been published in the British journal Nature about 2-3 years ago. You'll see a reference on our website, and the answer is 4.5662 billion years, plus or minus 0.0001 billion. It's now known to 5 places the decimal. How do we know it so accurately? Mainly through a set of independent radiometric dating techniques. So, for example, they were able to date these primordial meteorites that were the building blocks of planet Earth. And that date, by the way, is when the Earth first came together as a body as large as it is right now, or almost as large as it is right now. And, you know, in these primordial meteorites, we will have two different species of uranium, uranium-235 and uranium-238, and you've got uranium thorium-232. Thorium-232 has a half-life of 14.1 billion years. Uranium-238, it's 4.5 billion years, and uranium-235 is 705 million years. So you've got three different radiometric isotopes with three different half-lives, and they decay into three different daughter products. Uranium-232 decays into lead-208, that's thorium-232. Uranium-238 decays into lead-207, and uranium-235 decays into lead-206. So, 238, 206, 235, 207, thorium-232, 208. Now, what's also interesting is lead only comes from radiometric decay. There is no such thing as primordial lead. It only comes from the radiometric decay of these radioactive isotopes, heavy radioactive isotopes. Now, the reason why we get such an accurate number, you've got six different tools. You can measure the quantity of thorium-232. You can measure the quantity of thorium-232, uranium-235, and uranium-238. So you measure how much of that stuff is still left in the sample, and we know how much was induced in those samples from supernova eruptions. Then you measure how much of the daughter products are there as well. Bottom line, it gives you six independent tools for getting the date of the sample. And they all agree, and they all give you the same answer, 4.5662 billion years. If you want to read more on this, I've got a book over there called A Matter of Days, in which I discuss this whole debate within the Christian community, is it thousands of years or billions of years? And actually, I describe myself as a middle-aged creationist, not just because of my age, but because I remember as a student, there was a debate going on in astronomy, is the universe trillions of years old or only billions of years old? And we quickly recognize it's middle-aged, it's not very old, it's only billions of years old. And by the way, what was stimulating that debate was astronomers recognizing if it's only billions of years old, then Darwin's theory of evolution can't work. That's not enough time to sustain Darwinian evolution. And so there was a 60-year battle going on in the astronomical community where non-theists were doing everything they could to prove that the universe was at least trillions of years old and finally had to concede it was only billions. And it's only billions, then biological evolution from a naturalistic perspective can't work. But there are Christians who believe that the days of creation in Genesis 1 are 24-hour periods. And most of my book over there, A Matter of Days, is going through all the creation accounts in the Bible and explaining why those days must be six consecutive long periods of time. It's the only way to read all the creation texts in the Bible without internal contradictions. And my point is, it's not enough to take the Bible literally. We have to take it literally and consistently. Okay, next.
Well, I wanted to preface this by saying that I am a believer in God and Jesus. But what I am skeptical about is the inerrancy of the Bible. And I can cite several. Does it not seem plausible to you? I believe that God did indeed impart His word to certain prophets through the ages, and some of them may have recorded it accurately, and some of them may not. But I just find, as I go through the Bible, certain parts of the Bible that just suggest to me that this must have somehow been corrupted along the way, because it's not consistent with what I hold to be a righteous and a loving God. I'm not asking you this as like you're the authority, but you're a scientific authority, and maybe from a scientist's point of view you can comment on some of that.
Yeah, give me one.
Pardon me?
Give me an example.
The whole notion of, I think of God as being the ultimate intelligence, the ultimate evolved being on the planet. And, for example, I don't see in any level, it's what I call an evolved position. That's one example.
Well, let me deal with that one. If you got another one, I'll be happy to handle it as well. Mm. And, I think that's the way to deal with these kinds of issues. One of the documents that we have at our office is one written by an atheist organization called 138 Contradictions in the Bible. And I find that an excellent training tool for believers to actually...
So 138 what?
Well, they claim that they found 138 contradictions or errors in the Bible. And we actually do is take our students through those 138 contradictions and say, resolve them all. And it's not that difficult to resolve them all. And to me, that's one of the most powerful pieces of evidence that the Bible really is.
Is that one of them, the jealousy of God?
That's in there.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. That's one of the 138.
Right.
So, and it's a translation, from the Hebrew into English. So it's not quite identical to our word for jealousy. But if you read the context of that passage, it's talking about what happens when God's people, the Israelites, begin to chase after false gods and find that those gods will disappoint them. They won't deliver. And, as it says in the New Testament, only God is good. He's the only being that's perfectly good in every way. And the problem with idolatry, and the text you're referring to is a text that deals with the sins of idolatry. And the reason why God wants to help us avoid chasing after false gods is He knows they're going to disappoint us. And when we get disappointed, we may give up on seeking after God. And He says, you need to seek after Me and only Me, because I'm the only one that will not disappoint. I'm the only one that is good. I'm the only one that will not let you down. I know better than you know what's best for yourself. That was a key thing in my becoming a Christian, was recognizing that because God is the creator of the universe, He knows better than I know what's best for me. And therefore, it's only logical that I should put my whole confidence and trust in God's direction of my life rather than trust myself to run my own life. And that's kind of the principle there upon worshiping God and only God. If God is the only perfect being, you want to make sure you're putting your trust in that which is perfect. And so forget the stock market. Forget chasing these little white balls on green patches of grass. Forget what's happening on TV today with the National Football League. no matter what team is your favorite team, that team eventually will disappoint. There's only one being that will never disappoint you. And so that's kind of the whole context of that passage is, I am a jealous God. I only want you to worship me, because I know if you worship anything else, it's going to disappoint you, it's going to crush you, it's going to defeat you. I'm the only one that can deliver. But hey, if you got another one, I'll take it.
Let me think off the top of my head. I mean,
well, if you want to go to the back of the line and then come up with it later, that'd be great.
Hello. So you accept the scientifically derived age of the Earth.
Yes.
And using that evidence, that same amount of evidence, we have a chronology of life coming from simpler organisms into progressively more complicated ones over, 3.5 billion years roughly. So why would God kind of sit on these single-celled organisms for, a billion years before slightly changing them and then slightly changing them again?
Right.
Well, why does it look like God had nothing to do with it if he did?
Good question. I'll try to give you a brief answer, but I've actually got about 6 chapters on that in the book over there called A Matter of Days. And here's a couple of points. When God created the Earth, like all planets, was filled with these enormous oxygen sinks. And to have advanced life, you need oxygen in the atmosphere, free oxygen, at about a 21% level. And if you actually look at oxygen, in fact, I could probably pull up a graph here for you, but it might take me too long. But there's a graph in the book that shows you the oxygenation of the planet with respect to time. Bottom line, it takes 3.8 billion years of very aggressive photosynthetic life existing on the Earth to get the free oxygen in the atmosphere up to 21%, which explains why God waited so long to bring human beings upon the scene. And when it hit 10%, that's when you got the Cambrian explosion. That's the first time oxygen levels were high enough that you could actually have large-bodied animals with joints and appendages and internal organs. Before that, there wasn't sufficient oxygen to support more than unicellular life forms or colonies of unicellular life forms. Although there was a little bit of somewhat complex life that showed up at the Avalon explosion, but hey, that was 575 million years ago compared to 543. At that point, the oxygen level was hitting about 8%, which was enough to support the Avalon explosion. Now, kind of lay this out for you. Every time the oxygen level rose, immediately you see God producing new life forms that can take advantage of that extra oxygen. There's no time lag. That happens right away. And it happens with optimized ecological relationships amongst the creatures that he creates. The evolutionary models would predict that there would be a time delay to take advantage of the oxygen, and also that when you see life showing up on the planet, it will not have immediately optimized ecological relationships. That, too, would take time to develop. But there's another reason. God knows that if we put advanced life on the planet 3.8 billion years ago, you're putting life on a planet where there's soluble metals in sufficient quantity that it will poison advanced life. It literally takes 3 billion years of sulfate-reducing activity to transform those soluble metals into insoluble metals as such that the 22 elements that could poison you are brought down to safe enough levels. And what's interesting about the 22 elements we see in the periodic table is that every one of them is what we call a vital poison. If the abundance is too high, it will kill you. If the abundance is too low, it will also kill you. Good examples would be selenium and chromium. They have to be at just right levels in soluble form. In order to get at the just right level, you need to create bacteria that will feed on the selenium or the chromium or the zinc, for example. And you want to have the population to be very high. And that's something we see in the fossil record. Sulfate-reducing bacteria were extremely abundant 2 and 3 billion years ago. Not so much today. Because today what you need from a crater's perspective is just enough sulfate-reducing activity to keep everything in balance. You don't want the soluble chromium abundance to go up or down. You want it to stay at the just right level for advanced life. And so that's what we see, is that you had this very high population, and then it dropped when the abundance level hit the just right level, and it's maintained at that just right level. There's a little bit more you can read about, but you know, there's topsoil you've got to build up. You also want to make sure you've got mineable metals, because without metallurgy, you're never going to have humans launching high technology civilization. And it's previously existing life that concentrates the iron, the zinc, the molybdenum, all the other metals that we mine for our high-tech civilization. They were all concentrated in the economically mineable forms thanks to unicellular life forms that predated us for several billion years. And so when I talk to my friends that are involved in the search for extraterrestrial intelligent life, my comment is you need to find a planet that can sustain bacteria for at least 3.5 billion years. Because if you don't have a planet that can sustain bacteria for 3.5 billion years, there is no hope you can ever have advanced life on that planet. But you can read more in the book.
Me again. You seem to spend a lot of energy arguing against finding life outside of this planet, somewhere in the universe. I tend to agree with you that we're not going to find it, probably. The evidence is not there.
Well, actually, I think we will.
Oh, you think we will? Okay.
We will find the remains of Earth life on every solar system body. And that's simply because Earth is so incredibly prolific with life for such a very long period of time, the remains of Earth life must have been transported in significant quantities to all the solar system bodies. In fact, I remember speaking at NASA Houston a few years ago, where I was encouraging NASA to transfer their resources from Mars to the Moon. Because it said in the surface of Mars, you've got about 200 pounds of Earth soil for every 100 square kilometers. But on the Moon, you've got 20,000 tons. And so we have an excellent chance of recovering microbes, or the remains of microbes that are embedded in Earth soil that's been transported to the Moon. And moreover, I was pointing out that the oldest fossils we have on the Earth today date at 3.47 billion years. But we have chemical evidence that tells us that Earth, that life is abundant on the Earth back to at least 3.8 and maybe even 3.83 billion years. However, the geology of the Earth has destroyed the fossils of Earth's first life forms. But there was also a period when Earth was being heavily bombarded by asteroids and meteorites and comets. And it was that bombardment that transferred, literally, billions of tons of Earth soil to the surface of the Moon. And that one astronomer calculated that almost all of that material arrived on the Moon at low velocity, high attack angle collision events, which means that the microbes would have arrived there virtually undisturbed. Now, of course, the ultraviolet radiation impinging on the Moon would kill those organisms. We don't expect to find any viable organisms on the Moon, but we should find pristine fossils of Earth's first life. And if we go to the Moon and find those fossils, we'll know who's right, the Christians or the atheists, on the structure of what those fossils will look like. Because you'll see in our book on Origins of Life, atheist scientists predict very different things about what those fossils should look like compared to we who are Christians. We can go to the Moon and prove who's right, the atheists or the Christians. And what I told the scientists there at NASA Houston was that, you know, the problem with Mars, it really only appeals to the atheist taxpayers. We're going to go to Mars and prove there is no God. But if we go to the Moon, we can either prove that the Christians are right or the non-Christians are right. And so let me tell you something about the U.S. taxpayer base. They were composed of Christians and non-Christians. Guess what? All of them were going to support this mission. So this is the best way to sustain funding, or one of the better ways to sustain funding for NASA. So we'll see what happens. I already am seeing some positive signs about them directing their efforts away from Mars and back to the Moon. So we'll see. We may actually have that experiment undertaken very soon. And by the way, in my visit to China, what I heard there is if the Americans don't do it, the Chinese will. They're preparing to go to the Moon, and they would love to prove whether or not God's responsible for the first life on planet Earth. So,
but
one of them will do it.
I was thinking more specifically, that's excellent, but I was thinking more specifically about intelligent life, you know, SETI, and everybody's looking for life
right
there. If they did find life out there, I mean, intelligent life, how would that negate Christianity? I mean, what's the threat?
It really wouldn't. In fact, about 20 years ago, three astronomers at Reasons to Believe wrote an article on that very point. Mm-hmm. And I took the position that we're alone in terms of intelligent life. And Sam Connor took the position, he's at MIT, he took the position that God is so compulsively creative, he's not going to be satisfied with just one planet. He's going to be creating life everywhere just because he really enjoys creating. And he said, you don't believe me? Look at the platypus. Look at all these amazing creatures that God has made here on the earth. Clearly it's a God that enjoys creating great variety and diversity. Therefore, he believed we're going to find life everywhere. And then Guillermo Gonzalez took a middle position, which was that God would create planets with bacteria and maybe some primitive vegetation, but nothing as advanced as mammals or birds. Now, where we did all agree is that based on what we see in Hebrews 9 and 10, we are the only planet in the universe where intelligent life exists that has a spirit component, in other words, the capacity to form a relationship with God that's in need of a Savior. Why? Because it tells us in those two chapters, the Creator of the universe died one time, one place, for all. He's not visiting thousands of planets around the universe. He visited one planet. But that does not rule out God creating dolphins on planet X. It only rules out God creating beings like us, who are body, soul, and spirit, and in need of salvation. That has been ruled out. And the reason why we wrote this article is to make the point that if you're coming from an atheistic worldview perspective, you have to believe that the origin of life is an automatic naturalistic event, and that it's automatic that that primitive life will naturalistically evolve into advanced life, and therefore the atheistic worldview has predominantly taken the position over the past few decades that intelligent life is everywhere. Let's build these telescope arrays and see if we can listen into the signals. You know, and I talked about my colleagues at the University of Toronto went on into the search for extraterrestrial intelligent life. They take an atheistic worldview perspective. And they make no bones about the fact that their mission is religious. We want to make contact with these beings because therein lies our salvation, our hope for delivering humanity from the problems that it is facing. But as I look at the universe, I don't see any hope for their paradigm, because every star we look at, every planet we look at outside of our solar system appears to be a non-candidate for advanced life. And moreover, we already have ruled out the distances. I mean, I was reading this morning about Stephen Hawking saying, we got to find another planet because we're messing up our planet. We already know there are no nearby planets we can run to. What do I mean by nearby? Anything close enough that we can get there before advanced technology would be terminated. And therefore, we are stuck with this planet. We already know there's nowhere else we can run to with any kind of advanced technology. The time it would take to get there is orders of magnitude greater than the maximum longevity for advanced civilization. What that tells us, they can't visit us, we can't visit them. And therefore, we better take care of planet Earth, because it's the only planet that we have any possibility of surviving in, given the laws of physics, And incidentally, that's the message you see in Job 37, 38, and 39. How God put humanity here at the best possible time, under the best possible conditions, so we could launch and sustain global civilization and technology. And what he's telling us in those three chapters, I want you to keep it the way I gave it to you. So it's kind of like parents telling their children, see this nice bedroom I've given you? I want you to keep it that way. But I think humanity is not doing a whole lot better than all of our children are doing and trying to take care of their habitats. But that's the message. Occupy till I come. You see it in Genesis chapter 1. God commands Adam and Eve, I'm putting you in charge of all the resources of this planet. I want you to maintain those resources for the benefit of all life. And so God gave it to us in optimal condition. We're to keep it that way.
Thank you very much.
Hi. This is about the Jesus' second coming, I guess. Now, what would happen if, let's say, planet Earth, we just destroyed ourselves, nuked the whole Earth tomorrow? How would that, the second coming, be explained?
Well, that would be a problem for Christian theology if we wipe ourselves out before the return of Jesus Christ to planet Earth. If that were to happen, that would disprove the Christian faith. I mean, you know, often when I'm debating atheists on university campuses, they ask me, what discovery or what event would disprove your Christian faith? I said, well, that would be one of them. Another one would be if we were to prove that the universe had no beginning, or if we were to prove that we human beings are no different than the animals. Those would all be catastrophic to the Christian faith. But the promise we see in the Bible is that the creator of the universe will return for a second time to planet Earth before we destroy ourselves. But if you read the book of Revelation and the book of Daniel, it will end in Ezekiel, Daniel, Revelation. They all prophesy that the creator of the universe will return just before we destroy ourselves. So evidently things are going to get to a point where it really looks like we're going to wipe ourselves out. And just in the nick of time, the creator of the universe comes back and prevents us from doing that. Now, I'll give you one example of where the creator has done that in the past, and that would be the flood of Noah. That was a point in history where humanity was in danger of self-extinction, and the creator of the universe intervened to prevent humanity from exterminating themselves. Evidently, according to Ezekiel, Daniel, Revelation, that will happen again. The Creator will rescue us just before we're on the verge of wiping ourselves out.
Okie dokie.
All right.
Hi. I had a question based on your discussion of the problem of evil. And you, when we're talking about Stephen Hawking's argument of kind of the multi-dimensional view of time, you critiqued it as a what-if argument, so it's kind of saying, what if it were this way to prove a point, which is admittedly a weak argument, I think, by most standards. But it seems that your discussion of the problem of evil seems to say, if we could only know the reasons, what if there's good reasons of what God is doing and chasing us and training us for the new creation with evil in this world, is that not also a what-if argument in the sense that it doesn't really answer the question of what is the sense that can be made of egregious evil, gratuitous evil that happens in the world, albeit natural evil or, you know, human evil? It just says, what if there was, you know, what if we could know the reason God was using? So I guess it seems, do we have to put gratuitous evil within God's providence in that sense? It seems that you would have to say it would only be a what-if argument. So in that way, if Stephen Hawking's argument is weak, is that argument in support of...
Well, I get your point, and it's a good one, and I didn't take it quite that far. I thought I was talking too much as it was, so
yeah.
I'm trying to abbreviate my comments.
Yeah, that's fine.
But something we take up in why the universe is the way it is, And what is it about the physics that plays into God's plan to rapidly eliminate evil and suffering once and for all? And so as a physicist, I've looked into the different laws of physics and say, why are they there? How do they work to restrain evil? And why does God only intervene on rare occasions? Because this is something that the disciples brought up with Jesus. They said, you know, what about those men that were killed by the falling down of the Tower of Siloam? And he said it had nothing to do with their virtue or lack of virtue. It's just simply an outcome of the laws of physics. And it was the same creator who said, you know, build your house on a rock, not on sand, because the laws of physics don't work too well for you if you build your house on sand as opposed to rock. Which kind of reminds me of all these manufactured homes that we put retired people in on the east coast of Florida. It's like, you know, here you are in hurricane land, you're putting them on the beach, and you're putting them in homes that really are not designed to withstand those conditions. Is that really wise? And you say, well, why does God create an earth with hurricanes in the first place? Turns out hurricanes serve a very good purpose. Earthquakes serve a very good purpose. Wildfires serve a very good purpose. I won't go into the details, but we live on a planet with the optimal number of hurricanes and the optimal intensity of those hurricanes to make life as pleasant as possible for advanced life on planet Earth. Conditions would be far worse if there were no hurricanes, or there were fewer of them, or of less intensity. Of course, it would be worse if it's the other way around, too. And the same thing's true of virtually everything that we refer to as, quote, an act of God.
Yeah.
However, God could easily get rid of earthquakes, fires, tornadoes, and hurricanes with different laws of physics. So why those laws? Well, it turns out that, say, the laws of thermodynamics work in such a way, you know, this pervasive law of decay, that the more evil we human beings commit, the more work we have to perform to undo the damage as a result of our evil activity. And the more pain we experience, and the more time we waste. I mean, you can see that in your own home. If you don't take good care of your belongings and your house, the laws of thermodynamics will work in such a way that when you finally do decide to do something, you're going to experience a lot more pain, a lot more work, you're going to have to spend a lot more money, and you're going to waste a lot more time.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the way God has designed us human beings, we hate extra work. We don't like wasted time, and we especially don't like pain and spending unnecessary money. So all of those things work to restrain us from committing evil deeds, because we realize if we do, there are consequences. I remember raising my two sons and telling them, look, if I don't discipline you, the laws of physics will. And, you know, the laws of physics are not going to play favorites. It's going to work on everybody. And it's for that reason that God chooses to intervene to save people from the laws of physics on rare occasions. Because what he recognizes is if he were to intervene and save us from every consequence of the laws of physics, then evil would never be restrained. And so he wants to make sure that we experience those laws of physics to a sufficient degree that the restraint has an impact. And that restraint also does something for those in authority. You know, the reason why we have police, the reason why we have an army, the reason why we have teachers and parents, is to make sure that the perpetrator of the evil suffers the consequences of wasted time, extra work, extra pain, and lack of income. Because the way the laws of physics work, it basically distributes the consequences to humanity as a whole. And one thing I noticed when I was raising my boys, how good they are at transferring the consequences of their misdeeds to their mother or to their father. And so I get stuck with the extra work, the wasted time, and the extra pain. And my role as a dad is to make sure that they're the ones that experience the consequences for their misdeeds. Likewise, that's why we have a justice system. That's why we have police. That's why we have an army, to make sure that the rogue nations suffer the consequences and not the rest of the world as a whole. Now, admittedly, we do it imperfectly. but the laws of physics are there to motivate those of us who have authority to exercise our authority. And we need strong motivation. Any of you who's been a mother or a father knows it's not easy disciplining your children. It's hard work. And if you don't do it, you're going to have even harder work to do. And therefore, it's incumbent upon us to do what's necessary to restrain the expression of evil. And all I'm giving you is the tip of the iceberg.
Yeah.
There's a lot more going on when you look at gravity and electromagnetism and all those other laws of physics. But what I find interesting is when I study the Bible, the moment that God permanently conquers and removes evil, he speaks the universe out of existence, replaces it with a new creation with radically different physics. There will be no thermodynamics in the new creation. There will be no gravity. There will be no electromagnetism. We'll even have different dimensions. We will no longer be constrained to length, width, height, and time. And to me, the wonder of the new creation, relationships will no longer be linear. They're going to be geometric. You see, what I mean by that is, I'm going to be able to relate to all of you with a one-on-one conversation simultaneously. You can't do that in linear time. You can do that in two, three, or four, or multiple dimensions of time, or their equivalent. Say, why doesn't God give us that now? If we were to give us that now, evil would run completely out of control. The physics is there to restrain the expression of evil for sufficient time that God can permanently conquer and remove evil once and for all. He's also designed the laws of physics in such a way that we only need to be exposed for a few decades. We don't have to live on this planet for thousands of years. Mm-hmm. We only have to live for a few decades.
Mm-hmm. Just one thing about the new creation thing. Theologically, how do you make sense of that in terms of the real new creation passages we get in Isaiah 60 or Revelation are very earth-centric in the sense that they talk about the inclusions of human products of culture and earthly animals and things. So, I mean, I wonder, it just seems very theoretical and not necessarily the Hebrew picture of God coming here and restoration
right.
as the new creation. It seems very, this otherworldliness seems to be kind of not... the biblical imagery is a this worldly image of the renewal as a new creation. So
well, be careful not to confuse the new creation with the teaching passages like those in Isaiah that pertain to the millennium. Because
well, yeah, that depends on your theological commitment, I guess.
Yeah, it depends on your theological commitment. And just so you know, I come from a pre-millennial perspective.
Yeah.
So I believe there will be a 1,000-year reign of Christ here on planet Earth before evil is permanently conquered and removed. And I believe what's going on in the millennium is God removing for a 1,000-year period every excuse for why we rebel and sin against God except the real reason. So we think it's because we have a poor economic system. He'll set up a perfect economic system. We might think it's because our parents weren't all that godly. Well, the only people who are going to be having children are those that are already perfected. I didn't get to see God. Well, he's going to be on television every night in downtown Jerusalem. Satan made me do it. He locks up Satan for 1,000 years, says that explicitly in the Revelation 19 and 20, that he'll be locked up for 1,000 years. And he says, some people think that it's eating meat. He says, I'll take away carnivorous activity. That will be gone. Which explains why the Isaiah passage talks about snakes and lambs and lions. It mentions these earthly creatures because all this happens here on planet Earth. For the very end of the 1,000 years, God releases Satan from his prison to test the children that are born during the millennium. And the principle is this. The only way you can get to the new creation is to first be tested. And so because those children haven't been tested, Satan is released to test them. And what does the text tell us? The majority of the children that had advantages none of us have right now in terms of responding to God, the same majority that rebel against God today are going to rebel against God again, making the point that the reason for our sin and our rebellion is what you see in Jeremiah 17:9 and 10. It's the human heart. It's not your external situation. It's not your parents. It's not the lack of evidence. It's the human heart. It's rebellion, a tendency towards rebellion and towards autonomy. That's going to be the reason why many people choose to reject. And so I look at the millennium as kind of like what happened before the flood. God is teaching the whole human race a lesson we need to know. It's not to our benefit to live 800 or 900 years. It's much better to live only 80 or 90. And it's not to our benefit to have all these external conditions removed. But once the millennium is over, then the universe disappears once and for all. And so I'm not a restorationist. There are Christians that believe that God is simply going to restore the earth and the universe to the pristine condition it had in the Garden of Eden. I don't see that taught in the Bible, and I certainly don't see it in the physics of the universe. The physics of the universe tells me the window of time is rapidly closing, and the only hope for humanity is if we leave this universe for a far better realm.
Hello. I have a theodicy question also. The smart lady in the front said that she had trouble believing because there's suffering, and if God allows that, he's either powerful but not kind, or kind but not powerful. And you said that suffering kind of prepares us for whatever's after this life. But then you later said that humans are the ones with souls, we're the ones who go on. So why then does God give non-human animals a central nervous system, the capacity to suffer and to fear, if they don't get to go on?
Well, I thought about that question myself about 6-7 years ago. I wound up writing a book on it. It's over there, Hidden Treasures in the Book of Job. Mostly about looking at the question, when you look at Genesis 1, there are three origins of life. Not just one, but three. There's the origin of the first life that's physical only, the bacteria, for example. And then we have the second origin of life on creation day 5, which are the soulish animals, animals that God endows with mind, will, and emotions, so that they can nurture one another, nurture their young specifically, where they can relate to one another, form emotional bonds with one another, but more significantly, where they can bond to human beings and serve and please human beings, each in their own specific way. And the 12th chapter of Job, Job says to his friends, "Ask the mammals and they will teach you. Go to the birds and they will tell you." They'll tell you things about yourself, they'll tell you things about God. And what he was getting at is this. When you look at these birds and mammals, and they make up 99% of all the soulish creatures, you can see that they're designed to relate to us. They have this powerful motivation to relate to us, and they want to serve and please us in specific ways. In fact, new research, which I write about in the book, talks about how cognitive psychologists and neuroscientists have discovered these animals will do things with us that they'll never do with one another. So you can tell that they're designed ahead of time to serve and please human beings. But just like they were created to serve a higher species, we were also created to serve a higher being. We are body, soul, and spirit. They are soulish, but they're not spiritual. And we're the only species of life on the planet that has even an inkling of the possible existence of God, or any desire to reach out and relate to a higher being.
So you think, but you've never been a dolphin.
Pardon me?
So you think, but you've never been a dolphin.
Well, yeah, I mean, you can see how, I mean, I've seen dolphins in the wild, and you can see how powerfully motivated they are to reach out to human beings. They just want to be around us. And that's also true of whales. In fact, I had a cousin who lives in British Columbia, and he told me the story of being out in a 7-foot rowboat by himself, and suddenly this 50-foot gray whale came right up beside his rowboat and wouldn't move. And he was worried that he was going to be capsized. That gray whale wanted affection. And then suddenly the gray whale disappeared. But about 10 minutes later, the mother gray whale put her calf up so the calf could get affection from my cousin. I mean, these creatures really are amazing if you study them in a state where they're not being abused by human beings. Where there's the abuse factor, you see them running away from us. But that's also a point that Job makes in his book. As we abuse these animals that God designed to serve and please us, instead of coming to us, they run away from us. And likewise, our sin does the same thing with our relationship with God. Instead of running towards Him, we run away from Him. So, as Job is pointing out, these animals teach us things about ourselves and about God. And if you actually look at the end of the book of Job, God steps in and says, okay, you've been discussing all these animals. And notice that some are easier to tame than others. But you human beings have been able to tame every single species of the soulless animals that I gave you. But some are especially difficult to tame. And the two that he mentions are the hippopotamus and the crocodile. They can be tamed, but it takes a lot of effort. The only way you can tame a hippopotamus is to take it from the time that it's newly born and spend time with it. And then that hippopotamus will relate to you as a pet when it reaches an adult stage. With a crocodile, you got to take it from the time it comes out of the egg, and you literally got to spend at least an hour a day with that crocodile, and you dare not miss a day. With a hippo, you can miss a day or two. Not with a crocodile. And for a long time, people didn't think crocodiles were soulless creatures. There's only recent research that has shown that they really do care for their young. So their newly born hatchlings, the mother will actually take the hatchlings into her mouth to protect them from predators. So it shows you that they do have, and they have the capability of emotionally relating to human beings if we take the time and the trouble. But then God steps in and says, there is one species of soulless life that human beings cannot tame. And that is another proud human being. His point is, only I can bring humility to a proud human being. And so as we tame these animals, it recognizes that that should help expose our need to be tamed by our Creator and allow Him to tame us. Those are a few of the lessons we get from those animals. But the thing that really amazed me is that God singles out certain animals. There's a top 10 list in Job 38 and 39. And God makes a point. There's about a paragraph of description with each of those top 10 animals where God makes a point. I designed this animal to launch civilization. And without those animals, you would have never gotten where you are today. And we human beings today, especially in the 21st century, think we got here by our own effort. The truth is, if God hadn't created hundreds of these different species of advanced life, we would have never been able to get out of the Stone Age. And as evidence for that, you can look at that top 10 list and recognize that most of those animals were wiped out by the first humans that went into Australia. The first humans wiped out 94% of the large-bodied bird and mammal species. Consequently, the Aborigines never got out of the Stone Age and were never able to build a large population. To a lesser degree, the same thing happened in North and South America. The Indians and the Eskimos were not able to get out of the Stone Age because they lacked the cow, they lacked the horse, they lacked the donkey. The creatures that were critical to the launch of civilization weren't available to them. And therefore, it took the Europeans and the Africans and the Asians to spread humanity over the surface of the planet. And, you know, that would be one of my critiques, too, about extraterrestrial intelligent life. They're not going to have technology if they don't have cows, if they don't have horses, if they don't have donkeys, if they don't have the eagle, the hawk, if they don't have the deer, if they don't have the ostrich. Go ahead.
Yes, hi. Well, I thought of another example, but you know, rather than me specifically name certain the example I called up here is just a passage from 1 Corinthians chapter 14, when it talks about, this is Paul writing, of course, and, you know, Paul had a lot of good things to say, but I cannot help but feel that Paul was a man of his times, and the times were very patronistic, and women were regarded very lowly. I cannot believe that a righteous, loving God really regards women in this sense. And I'll just quote from it. My smartphone stops acting smart for a second here. It says, the women should keep silent in the churches, for they are not permitted to speak, but should be in submission, as the law also says. If there's anything they desire to learn, let them ask their husbands at home, for it is shameful for a woman to speak in church. Now, this to me seems like just an anthropomorphism of God. I mean, I don't doubt that Paul was very inspired by God to speak much of God's truth, but I cannot believe that this passage has not somehow been corrupted. My question is, why do you believe in the absolute inerrancy of the Bible? And if so, why? What is the scientific basis for that?
Well, I do believe in the inerrancy of the Bible, with a couple of caveats. When God is quoting Satan, don't expect Satan to be telling the truth.
Say that again? I'm sorry.
But I mean, as far as what God is communicating to humanity, uh-huh. It is truth and nothing but truth.
Right.
So I believe that passage from Paul, likewise, is truth and nothing but truth. However, when you run into situations like that in the Bible, and you know, this happens on a number of fronts, and this is the whole basis for a paradoxes class, to take passages like that and say, what's going on? And how do you resolve that in the context of an inerrant Bible? You know, people who have been attending our paradoxes class know the answer. We're going to look at every passage in the Bible that deals with that topic. And so before charging the Bible of inerrancy, let's read everything Paul's got to say about the doctrine of women. And for that matter, let's look at the other 38 authors of the Bible and see what they got to say about women. And let's see if we can read all these passages in a way that is consistent. And what you'll discover is that in Paul's 13 biblical books, he frequently talks and commends women for their ministry and commands women to minister, to teach, and to prophesy, for example. So how do you reconcile Paul, it's the same guy, commanding women to pray and to teach in public in the church, and at the same time telling them
to be silent,
not to teach, and yeah. to be silent?
Yeah.
Well, I was actually put on a doctrinal committee here at the church to study that very question. And there were three of us who spent 6 months deliberating that very question. And what we discovered is that there are two Greek words for teaching. And where Paul is commanding women not to teach, it's the word authentein. And notice that you see in the New Testament, you've got preaching and you've got teaching. And what he's basically saying is that women have the freedom to teach men in the church, but they don't have the freedom to preach. And you say, what's the difference? But you can kind of tell by the word authentein. It's the word where we get our word authority from. And so what he's saying to women, when you're teaching men in the church, teach in such a way that you're not exercising authority over them. And what he means by that is teaching in such a way that you're commanding them to change their way of life. But he's giving them complete freedom to inform men about doctrinal issues, about the meaning of the text, about applications we can make from the meaning of the text. But what we did in our committee is we actually ran some experiments. We said, you know, let's actually violate this command and see what happens. And let's obey the command and see what happens.